Richard Johnson is not the greatest architect of our time. If very few people credit him a leading architectural talent, many can't deny how influential and powerful he's been for almost a century. He invented the term international style on the occasion of the exhibition he curated at the Museum of Modern Art in 1932. He categorized those features common to modernism across the world. Together with Alfred Barr, introduced Joseph Albers to the newly founded Black Mountain College. It was the bridge between America and the Bauhaus. He supported many great architects who, thanks to his patronage, could shape the modern face of America. Together with Mies van der Rohe, is the grand watermark figure behind Points on a Line, the new video by Sarah Morris. Our story starts in New York at the First Season restaurant.
Well, that's a hard question to answer. How did I come across Philip Johnson? But I guess I probably came across him physically in the sense of that I love the Four Seasons restaurant. I was always very fascinated by the Seagram building and how it looked, this brown and yellow building on Park Avenue. And I had done a painting of this building. To me, this building was like an important piece of real estate in the city of New York and an important intellectual history in the city of New York. And I used to go sometimes. I think maybe the first solo show that I did in New York, I had lunch in this restaurant the day of the opening. And I saw Philip Johnson in the corner table. And he had somebody who walked him in and walked him out. He still had an office in the Seagram building. And I went over and introduced myself. That's probably the first time, you know, saw him in his own environment. And I thought this was really very powerful image of this person who had designed every single detail down to the shades, to the ashtrays, to the bar, to the way the tables are laminated. And it's actually one of the few interior spaces in New York that's actually a landmark. The restaurant is a landmark on the interior, not just the exterior. So I was fascinated by this. But, I mean, aside from the architecture angle, which, you know, is there and it interests me, I mean, I'm not so much interested in architecture, believe it or not. I'm really interested in using architecture as a means for cinema, as a sort of cinematic fantasy, if you will. And it interested me, his role in relation to art, Philip Johnson. I mean, he was a real power broker. He was a real networker, which is why that Rolodex scene in the film, Points on a Line, is so important, because he really amassed a large sense of, like, introducing people, enabling people to sort of become themselves. And I say that in the best possible way. I mean, I know there's a lot of people who really detest Philip Johnson because he really did have a lot of power. I mean, he was very powerful at Museum of Modern Art for like many, many decades. And of course, there is his history in the 1930s, which is very problematic. But aside from that, he was like somebody who really, if you really think about it, he enabled America to have the image that it now has. And this image is like built and created by one man's idea, which is Mies van der Rohe. And when Mies van der Rohe did these drawings in the 20s of glass skyscrapers, he only was able to envision them there in Germany, but he actually built them in America. And this became the physical reality of America. Now it's the physical reality of, like, the entire world. But this is fascinating, this sort of lineage of the connections between very specific people, not vague ideas, not abstract, like very specific set of relationships. Philip Johnson asked Mies van der Rohe to design his apartment in the late 20s in New York when he was still, like, a student. And this type of prevision, Philip Johnson had a prevision of what could be, and he had a real eye for talent, both in the art world and, of course, in architecture.
P- Points on a Line is a portrait film about two pivotal buildings, the glass house designed by Johnson in Connecticut and the Farnsworth House designed by Miss Van der Rohe in Illinois. The video, that is about a common vision, complicates the debate around the emergence, the publicness, and the authorship of an idea. Chicago follows many other American cityscapes produced by Sarah Morris: New York, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Washington. Chicago is the city that welcomed the European modernist vision, from Gropius to Miss Van der Rohe.
For me, the two films function as almost like non-identical twins. Points on a Line is really about this relationship between these two men, and also this sort of hidden relation between women that are very important in the making of these structures. Phyllis Lambert was the person who convinced her father to have Mies van der Rohe build the Seagram building, and she was absolutely pivotal in creating the Seagram building. That became a Mies van der Rohe project. I mean, she curated it, in essence. And then with the Farnsworth House, Edith Farnsworth was the person for who this house was made. And so there's a tension there in the film also about gender, but the main issue in the film is really about the relationship between these two men and this idea of the copy and the original. And maybe it is that the copy or the person who comes after is more important than the original. Like, how important is the original moment or the original creator of an idea or an image? Because I think Philip Johnson, for sure, as he was curating a show, a solo show on Mies van der Rohe, got this idea to build a glass house. And this really came from Mies van der Rohe, and there was a huge sort of tension between the two men about this, because Philip Johnson did it first, even though the idea was Mies van der Rohe's. They're very different interpretations of the same concept, but I like this play with time. You know, time is not linear. If you look throughout history, you can find many examples that are like this, of somebody doing something, either stealing an idea and doing it first and then gaining glory for it, or somebody who's an enabler of somebody else. Like, I don't think Mies van der Rohe would have become Mies van der Rohe had it not been for Philip Johnson. And Mies van der Rohe, in turn, when he was deliberating about how to leave Germany, was debating, should he go to Harvard or should he go to Chicago? And he chose Chicago because Chicago was not only very architecturally rich and interesting and very wealthy city at the time, but also because it was a blank slate. It was a place where he could actually realize, he knew he would be able to realize his vision there. He knew he would be able to sort of create what he wanted to create. And he met enough people and a specific developer to create those buildings, Lakeshore Drive, Federal Plaza. I mean, the whole city is sort of, I mean, in a way, the whole city, including the campus of IIT, where he was the president of architecture or the dean of architecture for decades, is all designed by Mies van der Rohe. It's like there's no other city in the world that has one architect's imprint so much. I think it's a very strong case anyway.
Coming to the method and the cinematic codes deployed, it is interesting to know how the artist has filmed the glass surface of the two buildings.
I mean, I never really think about the technical difficulties of anything. I really don't. I don't approach things by thinking about this. I mean, if I did, I would have never become a painter because I didn't study painting and I know nothing about painting. But of course, you know, you teach yourself as you go on with things. You teach yourself as you're going through a process that's difficult. And I often say to people who are working for me that art is really problem solving, constant problems, constant difficulties, constant headaches, and that you have to go through this and you have to have a sense of humor and you have to be able to deal with it. But definitely shooting glass houses is about as like the, one of the most tricky things because of the reflections, because of things not color-wise, not reading properly and whatnot. So we had to make, we had to learn as we were working. Yeah, and you start to realize this invisibility issue is not really so invisible.
And that's even more interesting in the light of the confrontation between the private and the public space that in both houses seems to vanish.
And that's a very interesting point because these two buildings, now they're public in the sense that anybody can have the ability to go to them and visit them. But these two houses were created for private residence, private space. There's no other way to put it. And what's interesting is they use the vocabulary of what we now know is like the most sort of dominant vocabulary of public space. So there's this strange juxtaposition of private and public only because the same techniques are used for public space. But when you really think about Mies van der Rohe, what he did and what was so clever about him, he was a very solipsistic, sort of hermetic person, is he really was able to convince people that his vision of public space, which was like a very fantastic vision in the sense of it was really out there to make these plazas with this glass and have these sort of like amazing vantage points and perspective, he really convinced people that this was like public space. But in fact, it's just an invention. It's just like his idea of public space. But he was able to convince people that his version of public space was everybody's version of public space. And it became, as I say, the dominant way we think about public space now or about building public space. But in fact, it's rather solipsistic. So when you see these private houses, you start to realize like, actually, this aesthetic version that Mies van der Rohe created, it could be private, it could be public. He just happened to sell it as public, as a public vision. And that's the perversity of Mies van der Rohe, is that actually he was able, that one person was able to like get that through, you know, because it might not have been that way. It could have ended up that public space looked extraordinarily different. I mean, in fact, we can go places in the world where public space looks very different, you know, but his version of it was very specific, and you can see how it can be adapted to private space as well, that there's a crossover there. And I really, you know, as an artist, I think about this issue a lot about private and public. I'm very, very private person. However, I view the vocabulary out there and with the media, I like to approach things, whether it's intellectual history or buildings or ideas or craft. I like to view all of these things as public. I view my political position is that everything is public. I'm not talking about the ideas that go on in your mind. I'm talking about like all these references, all of these, this vocabulary, all of this like palette, if you will, this is all public. It's all public space. And in a way, Mies van der Rohe and Philip Johnson created that, started that idea in a way, because they had a very generous sense of playing with this concept of public space and making that happen in a way. I mean, if Philip Johnson saw a painting that the Museum of Modern Art wouldn't buy or they couldn't come to a decision on it, he would just buy it for Museum of Modern Art because he had enough money. He would just like bring that into the museum. And this is like an incredibly interesting position to have. He was a real power broker and he was very complicated person, perhaps, but and he definitely was somebody who added on. Like he was not somebody who had only one theory. You know, and this also interests me. It's the same reason why I made the film Capital with Bill Clinton during the end of his administration in the year 2000, is that I really like this intellectual approach, this mental approach of not saying yes, but, and being like rigid in one's thinking and rigid in one's like agenda or paradigm, but being like yes, and definitely Philip Johnson had this same thing of yes and. You see it, how he changed his style and would constantly, I mean, he's been accused of copying many, many times, but he would change his style and he would develop and continue to develop as decades went on. And actually, when you see the glass house, it's not just the glass house. There's a bunch of other structures around the glass house where he continued to experiment. This is like a very interesting model, and I definitely think it's how most serious artists approach their work. Yeah, I mean, of course, he was an architect, but I think this is very noteworthy. But, you know, I think Philip Johnson definitely gets a pretty bad rap. I mean, wherever I travel, people are like, yeah, he was a really mediocre architect. And it might be true, but, you know, he still, in his own limited way, enabled something very, very interesting to happen, and it really changed the image of the world. And you're right, it did all start with Bauhaus.
Our story ends where the cinematic codes meet the surface of two spectacular boxes. But to understand how architecture and moving images had in those years the first interesting date might be a good starting point for further thoughts.
Well, I think any really great architect or artist, there is always this idea of the reproducibility of your work, of your architecture, of a story if you're a writer. I mean, there is this ability, you know, for something to travel in people's minds or an imprint of it. So going back to this idea of like the cinematic and architecture, for sure they were absolutely influenced. Mies van der Rohe was influenced by the idea of the spectacular or the cinematic or, you know, this fictive space. And that's why I think it's interesting that he was able to sort of convince people that this is an idea of public space, because actually, you know, public space, as I said before, could be anything. But he, you know, developed this idea of like walking across a large plaza before you get to the building. Like, that's very cinematic. Like, to me, that's like you're ending up watching somebody. You know, there's a durational element to that. The same way as in Las Vegas, you're driving down the strip for 30 minutes before you get to the Golden Nugget. You're taking it in. You're sort of absorbing the sense of the scene, the mise-en-scene, before you're somewhere. And I'm sure he was influenced by Jacques Tati. I'm sure he was influenced. I mean, like, there's tons of different influences I could point to that point out the cinematic element of this. But for me, it was really something very special to spend time in these two structures, and also this to wrestle with this very sort of postmodern concept of maybe the copy comes first before the original, that time is not linear, and that actually in some levels of mediocrity there can be a sublime.
This interview is produced by Radio Papesse. It was recorded on the occasion of Lo Schermo dell'Arte Film Festival 2011. RadioPapesse.org